This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
To our immigrants worried about the knock on the door, change can't wait. To women whose rights are perpetually under attack, change can't wait.
Well, that is Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley and her huge upset victory in a Massachusetts Democratic congressional primary earlier this month. Pressley ran against Michael Capuano, a 10-term incumbent and also a progressive Democrat who differed very little from Pressley in terms of politics and policy. Nevertheless, voters overwhelmingly picked Pressley in a landslide 59-41 win, seemingly enthusiastic about the idea of swapping the experience that comes with incumbency for the experiences that come with a different kind of life. Pressley is the presumptive congresswoman-elect from Massachusetts 7th District, and that is because there is no Republican running against her in the general election in November. So she will almost certainly become the first black woman to represent Massachusetts in Congress. Now, her win follows Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's congressional primary victory in New York and Andrew Gillum's gubernatorial primary win in Florida. So is the restive energy in the Democratic base turning into something that looks like a viable insurgency? Well, joining us now in the studio is Ayanna Pressley. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. It's good to be with you again, Meghna.
Okay. So first of all, maybe folks on the internet saw this video of you when you were first told that you had won this congressional primary. It's almost like a meme now of women being surprised that they've won in these insurgent campaigns. I mean, you look genuinely shocked in that video. How shocked were you?
It was a purely authentic, organic amazement. I was stunned. I had been readying myself immediately before my aide came in to take the stage in defeat, and was sort of readying myself for what I was going to say to this room, because I knew I had seen and felt what we were building out there. And I saw especially millennials, many of whom had been in a fetal position since 2016, who had come out and we had restored their hope. And then there were many who had never participated or been engaged in the process who we had given hope. And I was sitting there thinking, I've written one speech. It has to work either way. And I'm not sure we pulled this out. And so how do I look into this audience and find a way to maintain the hope that we have given or restored?
You were preparing yourself for defeat, but your victory was 59-41. I think, you know, for a lot of political observers in Massachusetts and around the country, you know, at best, people were thinking it was going to be close. I mean, what does that blowout tell you about what people, you know, at least in this particular Massachusetts district, are looking for?
Well, it confirms some of what I already knew, which is that polling undersamples the electorate that we were working actively to engage.
These are people who are not necessarily likely voters.
Correct. And again, even I knew we had a path to victory, but I was prepared to lose, but I knew we had a path to victory. And I was sitting in, the victory ultimately will be that we have changed the way electoral politics and campaigns will be done for the future. We ushered in a new paradigm shift. And I think it proves that, one, you cannot gauge transformation. And there was a shift occurring. We could feel it beneath our feet out there. When I went to a shelter to spend time with women experiencing homelessness, and one of them, as I entered, said, I love your number one bus video. And I can't wait to vote for you because change can't wait. I said, something has happened.
This is a campaign video that you put out
about the disparities,
the income disparities across this particular Massachusetts district.
That I felt could be summed up in a bus ride from Cambridge to Roxbury. And so when I had 14-year-olds that were canvassing on days that it was quite literally like walking the surface of the sun, and 250 incarcerated black men at MCI Norfolk endorsed my candidacy and were organizing their families on the outside, I said a shift is occurring.
Yeah, but I don't know, personally, let me ask you something. I mean, you said on the on voting day that you do feel as if this particular race was yet another one that was emblematic of this battle going on for the soul of the Democratic Party. But I do wonder how much we, folks should actually read into your victory, because there are some, things about the 7th Massachusetts district in particular. I mean, there are the state's only majority minority district. It is a very, very reliably blue district. I mean, you on the campaign trail were talking about how it's, the former seat for John F. Kennedy, Tip O'Neill, et cetera. And in fact, on the campaign trail, you said, if Democrats can't embrace being bold here in this particular district, where can they? So my question for you is, regarding this, the battle of the soul for the Democratic Party, I mean, isn't the 7th Massachusetts district somewhat of an outlier? I mean, is that same battle going on in more centrist districts across the country? How much should we reading into your victory?
I think the battle in this race, and there were policy differences between myself and my opponent, and there were campaign differences. We didn't accept corporate PAC money. We raised $1 million in grassroots donations. I was calling for the defunding and the abolishing of ICE. I was spotlighting different issues relative to disparity and inequality. But I think ultimately this was a generational shift, less of an ideological one, although I think it was a style difference. I was running on bold, visionary activist leadership. As I have said repeatedly since Tuesday, 1 week ago today, that I think our victory was less a referendum against hate and more a mandate for hope. Our campaign was not just about the resistance of resisting Trump and the policies of he and his administration. I don't feel as a Democrat, because we're in the minority and especially sitting in the 7th seat, that we should be putting our hope and our aspiration and vision for this district on a shelf because we're in the minority. I'm not going to treat Kavanaugh as an inevitability, no matter how sobering the landscape. We had a phone bank in my headquarters last night to lobby senators. And so I think what was deeply resonant and transcendent is that I was offering bold, visionary, activist leadership, which was giving people hope. And that was not a lot of the messaging that was happening in many other campaigns.
Well, I guess what I'm wondering about is perhaps the Massachusetts 7th District has a high appetite and desire for that kind of activist leadership that you were campaigning on. But, like, people across the country are wondering what direction the Democratic Party as a whole is going to go.
I'm wondering.
Do you see that same appetite elsewhere or not?
I think wherever you are, we are still in the midst of, I called it on the trail an identity crisis, and that might be too dramatic an offering, but we need to get it straight. I do think that we are presenting false choices to one another internally in the party. I reject that this is about working class white voters versus everyone else. I reject that this is about jobs in the economy or criminal justice reform. Our destinies are tied. We are a big tent. There are many seats at the table of democracy. And the silver lining of this administration has been that our organizing silos are breaking down. And so, to me, we are at a crossroads as a party. And this can be our darkest hour or our finest. And I think it's our finest if we sit in the place of coalition and movement building. We don't pawn off the hurt on one constituency at a time. We say that we are going to stand for trans rights. We're going to stand for immigrants' rights. We're going to stand for women's rights. We're going to stand for workers' rights. That is who we are. So the fight for the soul of the party is a return to who we have always been foundationally. And it is a resurrection of those foundational premises.
So this is really interesting because, now you're, presuming all goes as expected in November in the general, you'll be heading to Washington. But I'm curious about whether or not party leadership sees this moment in the same way that you and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others see this moment. And here's why I ask. Because, for example, after the Alabama Senate special election and last year's Virginia gubernatorial race, there were a lot of headlines that said things like, quote, the Democratic Party owes black female voters a big thank you. Like, lots of talk about how African-American women are at the heart of the Democratic Party right now. But in this race, in your race against Michael Capuano, when it came to endorsing or supporting your candidacy? I got a list here. The Congressional Black Caucus's PAC endorsed Capuano. Representative Gregory Meeks told the New York Times that we've got nothing against the challenger. That was you. But when you have a colleague that's done the right thing for 20 years, you work with him. We know him. Congressman John Lewis even campaigned in Boston for Capuano. And he said, in Boston, it's important to keep a leader, a fighter, and a warrior like Mike Capuano around. Former Governor Deval Patrick also endorsed him. It's my long-winded way of saying, if there is a battle going on for the future of the Democratic Party, do you think the Democratic establishment, the Democratic leadership represents that and what or recognizes that? And what lessons ought they learn from your victory?
Yeah, Meghna, this race and our victory has garnered national attention. I do believe it will become a case study in many ways. Again, I think it is a bellwether, and I hope it will prompt us to shift course and to throw away assumptions of who is a likely voter and to invest the resources to engage everyone. Secondly, I think we will, a lot of organizations are going to have to reexamine their litmus test, and that perhaps there will not be an immediate default to incumbency, that perhaps there will be a more equal weight given to considering a candidate and their bona fides and what they have to contribute and what their message is. I think that polling completely goes out the window in terms of the viability test. I hope that what we will see a shift is in how campaigns are run and won and the candidates that are embraced. And I should add, so far as the CBC PAC and so many others, they were amongst the first calls that I received election
after
night.
After
Congressman
the
Lewis probably called me, you know, 30 minutes after we announced. And so I'll be in D.C. this week for Congressional Black Caucus Week. They are embracing me with open arms and looking forward to governing with me.
Ayanna Pressley, I want to ask you something looking forward here, because I'm seeing some parallels, broadly speaking, between what's going on now with Democrats versus what went on, say, in 2010 with the Tea Party and insurgents in the Republican Party. And I just wanted to see what you think about this, because one of the reasons why I think Tea Party Republicans have been so effective is not only did they get elected, but once they won their races and were in office, they formed a really influential caucus, sometimes to the chagrin of Republican leadership. They really sort of stood their ground on issues they believed in. And I'm wondering, you know, in order to really drive your agenda and your activist ideas that you say you want to bring to Washington, are you and perhaps other, we'll see who gets elected in November, but other newly elected Democrats sort of willing to do the same?
I think it's certainly a conversation worth having. We'll see after the midterms who's standing and where there's that natural alignment of value and policy priority. Certainly there is strength in numbers, and we'll be more effective if we can be in coalition and tactical in that way. But I want to just continue to underscore how important it is to me to be in community and organizing with residents in the Massachusetts 7th. If you look at the Affordable Care Act, and I also think this was a resonant message of our campaign, that was ultimately saved, not because of the conviction of lawmakers, but because of the courage of individuals and families who went to Washington, who organized, who mobilized, and who forced the hands of lawmakers to do the right thing by them because they knew that lives were quite literally hanging in the balance. This is what I ran on, is the need for us to have activist leadership, someone that will coalition and movement build and extend a hand of partnership. That is what these times require. That is what the district deserves. And so I very much hope to have the opportunity to tactically organize and to be in coalition with my colleagues that are of like minds in Congress. But what I will never lose sight of is the fact that it is my job to lift up the stories and the struggles of the people in the Massachusetts 7th, to harness their innovation and their ideas, and to do this work in partnership with them. That is the thing that was the most resonant and continued. Just this morning, I was doing thank you standouts throughout the Massachusetts 7th, just shaking hands and hugging people and thanking them for for what they've entrusted me with. This is an awesome responsibility. I don't think I've even connected to the electoral victory because I've just been focused on the awesome responsibility and the work that lies ahead and making sure that I'm doing my part to restore the hope and the trust and the confidence that we've earned. And what people were responding to over and over again was, and people just cried, especially the millennials, they just cried, thank you for giving us hope and thank you for making me feel empowered. Because they were feeling incredibly defeated and dispirited. And so we have to organize, we have to mobilize and be in coalition.
You know, I hear you and your focus on the people who you will soon be representing in Congress. But, you know, we just got a minute left to go here, Ayanna Pressley. I keep coming back to this question. I mean, do you think that the restiveness that was communicated in this particular primary in Massachusetts, I mean, is it emblematic of what's happening elsewhere, or is your victory an outlier for Democrats?
I think it's a shift. I feel a paradigm shift, and I am proud to have played a role in ushering in that shift, which I do believe is generational, but is also about the practice of governance and how we do this work and how we run campaigns. Again, no corporate PAC money, investment in ethnic and specialty media, expanding the electorate. Every constituency that people would consider to be flux or unreliable delivered for us. And that is because we treated them as an equal partner. And so I hope that those are the takeaways, and we will be sure to bring that message to Washington. And I do think that there is an appetite, not only from the electorate, but in leadership for this shift. Otherwise, otherwise.
Otherwise. ellipses.
I think there are many takeaways and notes, and people, you know, are going to build new muscle and build it quickly.
Well, we'll see if that happens. Ayanna Pressley, she is the presumptive Democratic representative from Massachusetts' 7th Congressional District. We say presumptive because no Republican is running against her in the November general election. She won a surprise landslide victory against a 10-term incumbent in the state's primary earlier this month. Ayanna Pressley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.